So I am joined on the phone today by author Kate Beaufoy's talk about her new book, Liberty Silk. So hi, Kate. Thanks for talking to me today.
Thank you very much. It's great to be on.
It's cool. So let's maybe start off by talking a bit about the storyline in your new book. Do you want to tell our listeners what it's about?
Well, it's a book that I did want to write many years ago. My mother actually came up with the idea for the book because she had a stack of old letters written by my grandmother back in 1918 at the time of the armistice.
Yeah.
She was living in Rouen in France. And my mother had always thought they'd make a great story. But the thing about these letters, and they were written for a couple of years between 1918 and 1919,
yeah.
Was that they were really very happy letters and very joyous. And my grandmother was a very young, free-spirited hedonist. And she had met my grandfather in Rouen at the time of the armistice.
Oh, wow.
They'd fallen in love. They were engaged to be married just 5 weeks later. And as I read the letters, I realized that I was in possession of a lot of her belongings still.
Mm.
Her engagement ring, for instance, that he gave to her
yeah.
on Christmas in 1918. The Liberty silk dress that she wore to celebrate her engagement that evening.
Yeah.
It was the 26th of December. And I had a sketchbook that she gave to him for his birthday 6 months later when they were traveling around France and Italy. He was an artist.
Oh, wow.
And I realised when I read that in the letter that I actually had the actual book downstairs, and it was full of his written observations, and it was full of beautiful sketches and watercolours, and it was only half full because he got very sick on their way home in Chambéry in France.
Yeah.
He got very sick and he nearly died. But he recovered, and the very last letter was written on a beach in Finistère in the north of France. And it was written in pencil, and she said, "Oh, cheerio, my dears, by Jove, what a holiday we're having." And the letters, there are about 40 of them that span that time, and they were very exuberant. It was a great insight into the way life was lived in the aftermath of the Great War. But my grandparents went on, of course, to live kind of happily ever after.
Mm.
And this is the second book that my grandfather has been in, because he was indeed, he was the rather sexy art master in The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie. So he's already received notoriety through Muriel Spark's famous
yeah.
novel. But anyway, I let the letters sit for a number of years until long after my mother had died. And there were a number of reasons why I decided to embark on them in the last few years. One
yeah.
was that I wanted to write something historical.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, what better introduction than through a real personal connection. I wanted to change my name. If I was going to write historical, I really wanted to take a new name on. I had been
yeah.
writing as Kate Thompson
yeah.
until then. And I thought, well, it's kind of serendipitous that I take my grandmother's surname.
Mm.
Her name was Beaufoy. And the other thing that happened was I was all set to write them, and lots of people have said to me, oh, did you write them to tie in with the anniversary of the First World War?
Yeah.
And I had to say no, because this book would have been on the shelves 2 years ago if I hadn't had a cancer diagnosis,
oh, no.
which put everything
yes, puts
back
everything
by a
back,
couple of
yeah.
years. I mean, having said that, everything is hunky-dory now. Everything's fine.
Fantastic, that's great.
But everything just seemed to be, my life seemed to be on a cusp, and it was time to do something new, something different,
mm.
and I've done it, and I'm really pleased with it. And the feedback I've got has been just fantastic.
Yeah. So was there a lot of research? Did the research for this book take up a lot of time?
Masses of time, really masses. Because I was expanding the story, I continued the story through from the 1920s in France through to 1940s. America, Hollywood,
mm.
and to 1960s, 70s, Ireland and London. And the reason I expanded to Hollywood in the 1940s was because it was an era that had always fascinated
yeah,
me.
Yeah.
And I just loved the glamour of it. And of course, the glamour is a real ersatz glamour, because the women who starred in those films were mostly you know, very well-paid slaves. They
oh,
had
yes,
absolutely
yes.
miserable lives. So what one was seeing on the screen, you know, the fabulous clothes and the beauty and the makeup and everything that looks so elegant and effortless and streamlined, in fact, that most of those women became either alcoholics or they were beaten, abused by husbands, by bosses. It was such a truly unpleasant time for a woman to live. But that, combined with the 1920s, I thought was a really heady recipe for something that would span three generations. And, of course, I was able to use the artifacts that were mentioned in my grandmother's letters as links, as narrative links. One of the little things I found was a tiny little Egyptian charm, a little representation of the god Anubis, the dog-head god of death. Yeah. And she mentions that in her letters, and I thought, I have that somewhere. And lo and behold, I went down to a dusty old jewellery box and found it in there. And that's something he had given her. So that informs the narrative of the book. That and the other artifacts, obviously, and the people that she meets. There's a lovely instance of when my grandfather was recovering in France. She talks about a beautiful Italian girl, and he's tearing his hair out because he has left his oil box in Paris and he wants to be able to paint her.
Yeah.
And the only portrait he can make of her is a watercolour. So she becomes a character in the book. And the other more sinister character is a man they refer to as a Greek count. Mm-hmm. And he's travelling. They meet up with him in San Gimignano in 1919.
Yeah.
And he travels with them to Florence. And he has in his company a very beautiful child, a little girl. And he asserts that the child is his adopted daughter. Mm. But we can tell by the tone of the letters that actually there's something really unsavoury going on. And, of course, at that time, there were drifters and people all over Europe without... You know, there was no kind of moral compass for anything. Mm. Everybody was... some very happily, obviously, like my grandparents were, I suppose they were prototype backpackers. But Europe was full of very strange, unsettled characters.
Yes.
And I reckon that this guy was really pretty unsavoury, actually. I think nowadays, if one had confronted him, you know, you would have realised he was probably a paedophile.
Oh, my goodness.
So all this thing, the book became a kind of a big soup of, you know, my grandmother's story and her artefacts and the people she met. Mm. I was able to weave into my own narrative.
Yeah, so it was a task of love, really, from, you know, taking the stuff from your grandmother and, you know, making it.
Yes, and all the letters that are quoted in the book are directly taken from hers. And I dedicate the book to her and to my own mother, whose idea this was a long time ago, and to my daughter. I've got three generations of strong women. You know, I just, that's been the way I've always lived my life, is believing in the strength of women to get through horrible times.
Yeah, no better way to be, definitely. So a lot of the book is based on fact.
The initial part of the book is based on fact, right up until what I did was, when they got to Finisterre, to the last stage of their journey, I split them up rather than have them return, because they returned and they lived in Edinburgh and they lived happily ever after. So I split them up. He goes his way and she goes down to Paris.
Yeah.
And the great thing as well about writing about those periods is you can bring in real life characters. I have Coco Chanel appears in the book.
That's fantastic.
And Pablo Picasso, of course, in Hollywood.
Yes.
We've got stars like Lana Turner and Ava Gardner and the Hollywood gossips like Luella Parsons.
Mm.
So I was able to pick from real life and fiction.
Yeah. So how long did it take to write from the initial, you know, like your mum saying, oh, you should write a book, to, was it quite a long period?
Well, my mother's been dead for over 20 years.
Oh,
and
wow.
In fact, interestingly, I was looking at her letters because I corresponded with my mother throughout my adult life while I was at university. And I found those letters recently. I was doing some research for a newspaper article. And in the last letter, she'd kept my letters. And in the last letter I ever wrote to her, I said, I have grandma's letters. And I'm not going to do anything with them just yet because I don't have time.
Mm.
And that was over 20 years ago. And it's only now, really, that they're seeing the light of day. So, in effect, it's been in my head for many, many years, but it was only latterly. In fact, I was all ready to go. You know, I had publishing house interest. I had a fantastic agent championing me. I changed my name. I was full of energy and get up and go. And then I got that diagnosis, and that just put life on hold for 2 years. As of course it does.
Yeah. So, I mean, how do you formulate your characters? I know you're saying some of are based on actual factual people, but how do you formulate characters that you're having to make to put into the book? How do you, what sort of process do you go through?
Well, very often they walk into your head. Mm. I for instance, the book I'm working on at the moment, which I have to deliver by the end of August, and it'll be on the shelves this time next year.
No pressure.
I was very interested in the 1840s in Ireland, and I knew that William Thackeray had come to Ireland in the early 1840s. And I also learned that he travelled with his wife, who was suffering from really chronic postpartum depression.
Mm.
And halfway across the Irish Sea, he was travelling with her and their two small children. She actually threw herself overboard. She tried to kill herself by throwing herself into the sea. And that character just stuck with me when I was reading, when I was doing my research. So I invented another character who would meet up with the Thackerays and who would meet up with Isabella Thackeray. And she was really meant to be an incidental character, but she's actually taken over the whole novel. She kind of walked in, and she walked in with such confidence. I liked her so much that I thought, okay, the rest of the novel is really just going to be a framework to tell Eliza's story.
Fantastic. No, it's not. It must be great to have a character such a strong character to build it around.
It's a funny thing, because I had to leave her on hold recently because I was doing a lot of publicity for Liberty Silk.
Yeah.
And I left her. I felt when I left her that she was a little bit like a CGI in a computer game. You know, she was there and she was abandoned. I'd left her on the landing of a house in London. And I just felt that she was floating there like a ghost waiting for me to come back and retrieve her. You know, but for the last 3 or 4 weeks, Liberty Silk has been my prime concern.
Yes.
And, you know, hoping that more and more people will write me the lovely letters that I've been getting, and fantastic tweets, actually. It trended. Marion Keyes trended with it on Twitter on publication date. So Liberty Silk was one of the top trends about 2 weeks ago, I suppose this was. And then we had a fantastic launch. My friend Kieran Hines, who plays Mance Rayder in Game of Thrones, launched the book for me in the Gutter Bookshop,
fantastic,
which is my local bookshop in Dublin a couple of weeks ago. So all that kind of wonderful fuss, Liberty Silk-related fuss, is over now, and I've got to get back to the grindstone.
Back to normality.
Yes.
Yeah, so, I mean, so do you use social media quite a lot? Would you use Facebook and Twitter? And
I don't really, and I have tried. I do use Facebook. I find it very difficult to kind of differentiate between the public and the personal.
Yes.
In that about 2 weeks before launch date, I said on Facebook, I'm really sorry, lads, but it's going to be wall-to-wall Liberty Silk for the next few weeks because I was promoting the book.
Yeah.
I did try very hard when Marion put out her wonderful Twitters about Liberty Silk, and she had a fantastic competition with six signed copies to go to winners. I did try and get into Twitter, but I find I don't enjoy it. And I think if you use it as a marketing tool, you're using it cynically, and it's not going to work for you. You know, and I'm very loath to. Mm. I mean, Marion really, really enjoys Twitter.
Yeah.
That's one of her things. She just loves doing it. But I'd be scared that I turn into one of those people who never tweet anything of any interest except to say things like, oh, my book got a nice review. And I'd feel wrong about that. So one of the reasons, in fact, that I've started writing historical fiction is because sometimes I feel I can't keep up.
Mm.
Because the eight, how many novels I wrote, I think this is my 14th, but all my other novels as Kate Thompson were written as contemporary women's fiction.
Mm.
And I was finding it more and more difficult to keep up in that, for instance, in my second novel, I have a reference to a floppy disk. And floppy disks now are completely obsolete. No, nobody, you know, under the age of 30 is going to know what a floppy disk is. So I thought, well, if that's the way technology is advancing, if I continue writing contemporary novels, this time next year, a novel is going to appear on the shelves where they say something arrives by post And everybody will say, you know, but nothing arrives by post anymore. It all arrives by drone. So I just think that everything is happening so fast that novels will be dated fairly soon. And with historical novels, especially if you do your research, and I really do work really, really hard at the research. Mm. I've been visiting the library every couple of weeks. Of course, online is fantastic, although you avoid Wikipedia because you can't trust anything that's written on Wikipedia.
No, definitely not.
But it's been a labour of love. And, of course, because I loved the 1940s so much, you know, being able to go back to all the books I'd collected when I was younger, all the film stars, biographies, all of that era of fashion was an absolute joy to research. And indeed, I'm finding the same now with the current book, even though it's set in the 19th as opposed to the 20th century.
So you were saying earlier, you've written a dozen or so other novels under the name Kate Thompson.
Yes.
How different was it switching from writing contemporary fiction to writing a historical book? Was it like you had to put like a totally different hat on to, you know, to get into the mindset?
No, I don't think so. Because my books are character driven.
Yeah.
They're not issue driven. It's not like, there's a wonderful novel I'm sure you know that we need to talk about, Kevin, which to me is more of an issue driven book in a way than it is character driven. I'm sure lots of people will argue the point with me, but I think it works the same way that successful soap opera, for instance, works when it's character driven rather than when it's issue driven. So, you know, for instance, if there's a gay character in a soap opera, you hope that that character is arising organically from the story, as opposed to just somebody sitting behind a desk and thinking, oh, we need to have a gay character because we need, you know, to represent the diversity of society. You know, so I don't think you can ever be cynical about a novel. You can never say, I'm going to write a historical novel because I enjoy writing about this period and I love writing about the fashions of the 1840s.
Yeah.
That helps, of course it does, but really the bottom line is you've got to love your characters. You've really got to love them, and you've got to make other people love them as well. And that's something I find difficult in a novel. If I don't engage with characters, I'm not likely to finish a novel, no matter how well it might be written. I'm such a sucker because in the old days, I used to read and reread Gone with the Wind, and I'm rereading it again because it's a real comfort read. And at night now, I just feel like I'm wrapping myself in a comfort blanket.
Yeah.
But I haven't read it for a while, and I do find I'm completely and utterly shocked at how politically incorrect it is. It was written at the time of the slave era, and it's almost enough to make me stop reading the book. But on the other hand, it's telling such a wonderful story, and the characters are so fantastic. I don't think there's ever been a heroine as beautifully rendered as Scarlett O'Hara. Once you've found a character that you love, you really can't go wrong, I don't think.
Yeah, most definitely. So how old were you when you started writing? Is it something that you've always done? It's just been a natural thing for you to do?
It's I've read since I could talk, I feel. I've been reading for as long as I can remember, and it's something that I passed on to my daughter as soon as she was able to read. You know, I was reading stories to her from when she was a tiny baby, and my mother had done the same to me.
Yeah.
So I used to, as a child, I used to escape into the world of the imagination big time.
Mm.
And in those days, now a lot of people can say, okay, I am going to become a writer, that's going to be my career path, or I am going to become a singer, or I am going to become a celebrity.
Yeah.
And it seems that you can embark on any path in life that you so choose. When I was younger, really being a writer wasn't an option unless you wanted to get into advertising.
Yeah.
I actually very much wanted to be an actress, so I did become an actress. My mother said, you know, get a degree behind you so you've got something to fall back in.
Yeah.
So I took a degree in French and English literature in Trinity. I came down to Dublin. I'm from Belfast originally.
Yeah.
And for years and years, I felt that the 4 years I spent in Trinity had been a waste of time because I always knew I wanted to be an actor.
Mm.
And then, of course, when I was a professional actor, I realised that my shelf life was looming.
Yeah.
And my best before date was hurtling towards me. So I thought, you know, is there anything else I might do that I might enjoy? Oh. And now it's become my livelihood.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, this is now my career. It's the way I earn my money.
Yeah, and I was wondering whether it's actually a full-time job for you now.
Oh, for sure it is, yeah. Absolutely full-time. And at the moment, because I have a deadline of the end of August,
yeah.
It's 7 days a week, and it's very often 12-hour days. It's incredibly hard work. And this is, I wrote an article actually recently for the Herald saying, oh, no, it wasn't, it was for a blog somewhere. But a lot of people will take down say they're in Tesco, and they take down a book and they flick through it and they go, I could have written this. I remember Maeve Binchy, wonderful Maeve, saying that people came up to her and said that to her face. You know, they'd say, well, you know, I really enjoyed your book, but, you know, I could have written that. And Maeve just very kindly would turn to them and say, well, maybe you could, but you didn't, did you? And that's the big difference, is that it's very easy to say,
yeah.
I could be an actor, I could be a singer, I could be a writer. But the fact is that most people don't sit down and put in the work.
Yeah,
you know, to for any of those disciplines, you have to be enormously dedicated, and you've got to work very, very hard. And that's been my kind of personal mandate since I was a child. Was, you know, hard work. I've always been a really hard worker.
Yeah, well, I think most of us have you know, done a course or something that you've totally regretted afterwards, and you feel it's a waste of time.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I suppose it's all life experience at the end of the day, I suppose, when you look at it.
I guess it is. I mean, I used to do night courses religiously every autumn.
Yeah,
and, you know, half of them were an awful... I did a course in furniture restoration, which was the worst. Funnily, having said that, Marion Keyes is just embarking on a course in furniture restoration.
Oh, fantastic.
So I mustn't put her off. But, you know, for me, that was a waste of time.
Yeah.
You know, really... If you love something and you want to learn more about it, then work hard to get your learning in there.
Yeah, most definitely. So just wondering, would you have any advice? I know there's a lot of our listeners are sort of would-be writers. If there's anybody out there that's thinking about maybe writing a book, what sort of advice would you offer to them?
Well, the most obvious thing, of course, is write it. And that's actually a lot more difficult than it sounds, because I remember when I first started writing, my husband and my daughter had gone off to Euro Disney, and I had announced that I was going to start writing a book, and they were gone for 4 days.
Yeah.
And I remember I kind of thought, well, how do you write a book? And I had no computer skills at that time.
Yeah.
So I kind of put on a floaty dress, and I lit a fire, and I lit a candle, and I laid out my exercise books, and I had a fountain pen.
Oh, wow.
And because that's what I thought lady novelists did.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, of course, a few months later, I had ditched. I was in the attic, actually, working in sweatpants, and I'd learned computer skills at that stage when my husband taught me how to cut and paste. It was just the most liberating thing. So there's nothing wifty wafty about it.
Yeah.
Don't wait for a muse to descend. I mean, for instance, the book that I'm working on at the moment, I've written a very lovely first chapter, and I sent it to my editor and my agent just to let them know how lovely it was going to be. But I have a suspicion that come the end of August, when the book is delivered, that first chapter may be gone in its entirety, or it will be a fraction of what it was.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you have to be ruthless, and there is that famous phrase, you know, take a dagger to your darlings, take a knife to your darlings.
Yeah.
No matter how much you love your characters, or the beautiful sentence, or the word that you love more than any word, and you spent ages constructing a paragraph that you think is, you know, just perfectly beautiful. More often than not, the more beautiful it is, really, the more it needs to be gone.
Needs to be done. Yeah, yeah. So what sort of books? I'm hoping that you get time to read books yourself. What sort of books would you read? Would you sort of tend to steer away from your own genre of writing, or is it you'll literally read anything and not worry about it?
I'll read anything. The book I enjoy, well, as I say, I'm reading Gone with the Wind at the moment for a comfort read. I finished The Goldfinch recently, which I absolutely loved.
Yeah, it's getting rave reviews.
I'm really looking forward to the new Robert Galbraith, you know, the
J.K. Rowling book,
detective stories. So I have a new one, I have that waiting for me. But I do find it really difficult to read anything else when I'm working on a book myself, which I guess is why I'm now back reading Gone with the Wind for the 14th time, because there are no surprises there, and it doesn't feel like working. Sometimes if I'm reading another book at night, I'll think, oh, that's a really lovely turn of phrase, and I'll maybe reach for a pen, or you know, I'll make a note, or else I'll go, oh, I really don't like that. You know, why didn't her editor cut that? You know, so I find I've got my critical cap on, whereas what I like to do is I like to read and enjoy, and I can't wait until September. Hopefully, I'll get down the West Coast in September and bring a stack of books with me and just sit and look at the sea and read for pleasure's sake, and not have to think about, you know, reading something that's the worst thing in the world. And I remember reading something of Marion's once, was when she put in an incident that was almost identical to something I'd written, and I rang her and I said, oh, Marion, I've just written that, and she said, but there are no new ideas under the sun.
You
get completely paranoid. Of course there are no new ideas, just don't lift them bodily from somebody else's work. You're allowed to be magpie-like from time to time and steal bits and pieces here and there, but you know, ultimately it's got to be your own book and your own work, and that's when how other people get pleasure in reading it, because it's a brand new thought about something maybe they've never thought about before.
Yeah, that's the thing I wonder about, whether you worry about getting influenced by, you know, whether authors worry about getting into influenced by reading other...
No, and I think that's a measure of when you know that you found your own voice. Because very often an author is asked, who is their greatest influence? And I don't think I have a single greatest influence at all. I just think that having read accumulatively through the years means that, you know, there are masses of influences. But I won't put my finger on a pulse and say, oh, I admire so-and-so, I really want to write like her. I want to write like, oh, gosh, who's that wonderful writer who wrote... Philippa Gregory, for instance, who, you know, is such a huge... a historical author. You know, I'm not going to write like Philippa Gregory, and she's not going to write like me, and yet we're both writing in the same genre.
It's about finding your own niche, I suppose, isn't it, at the end of the day? It's about finding
your niche, where you're happiest writing and most comfortable, and also, as I said before, it's, you know, when your characters start talking to you, and also when they start acting independently of you. You know, I remember another lovely time when I had my characters together in a kitchen in a house in the west of Ireland, and suddenly I heard a door open and somebody's footsteps coming down, and as soon as I heard her footsteps, I knew I was going to hate her, and I did. You know, but she became quite a pivotal character in the narrative.
Oh, dear. Fantastic. So, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today, Kate.
Thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure.
It's been fantastic.
And I hope you're able to emerge and enjoy some of the sunshine.
I hope so. I hope so too. So, Liberty Silk by Kate Beaufort is published by Transworld Ireland, and it's available in all good bookshops now. So, go out and get yourself a copy today.